Welcome to another episode of Europe's B2B SaaS Sales Podcast. Today with a true legend, Andy White, founder of Medic, even trademarked because like it helps so many sales organizations qualifying out more. It helps people like close more revenue from less people sometimes because they don't jump on every call. Also really interesting to speak about, like nobody regrets qualifying out. I guess that's like as an elite athlete, the things that you don't do are just as important as the things that you do. So over to you, Andy. Thanks so much for taking the time. And if you want to share two actionable insights that can help people qualify better already starting today, that's great.
Sure. Well, hey, Manuel, great to speak to you. Great to talk to your audience on this fine Monday morning. What a great time to do a podcast as you're ready to rock and roll for the week. I don't know when this will go out, but I'm ready for a big week. So yeah, two actionable insights. Well, you kind of touched on one there. I tend to talk about qualification a lot. I think one of the first actionable insight I'll say, and it's an insight from the perspective, I think our industry gets qualification wrong a lot. I think we think about qualification from the basis of, is there a deal here for me? Am I going to be able to, you know, add an opportunity to my CRM system? Am I going to be able to tell my boss, my, you know, investors, whoever it is, that I've got some more pipeline this month, this quarter, whatever it is? And that's the wrong way thinking about it. You should be qualifying from the basis of, is there enough mutual value that you can provide to this customer that it's going to be worth not just the customer's while entering into what we know in our industry can be multiple weeks, multiple months of engagement, but also your perspective as well, as your time is, particularly in earlier stage startups, one of the things that's finite is the amount of time you have. And so qualification, the first insight I'd say is qualify from the basis of, first off, is there enough value in our product for this customer for it to be worth their while and my while? Are they willing enough to enter into that engagement with me? That's the first thing I'll say. And the second thing, the second actual insight is really simple. It's kind of an extension of that, which is that if not, if there isn't enough value, or, you know, whether the customer's not willing to enter into that engagement with you, qualify out, because one or two things will happen. The first is the customer will agree with you, and you will have saved yourself a load of time, heartache and hassle. Or the second thing that will happen, which happens in like, it never stops ceasing to amaze me how often this happens when I go to qualify out of a company that, you know, they seem like they're not interested, they seem like it's not a priority, is all of a sudden their behavior changes. And yeah, all of a sudden they start, I think, behaving more like an interested party. And that could be because they, you know, some customers, particularly more sort of immature buyers, they think that by showing interest that they'll, you know, that's a bad thing as a customer. They shouldn't show interest. They should pretend they're not interested, because if they show too much interest, you're going to be, you know, you're going to perform some sort of Jedi mind trick and slide a contract and, you know, a contract in front of them or something like that, when we know that's not the case. The best deals, the deals where the customer gets the best value from us throughout the experience, are the ones where they work most closely with us. So, you know, typically if you go to qualify out, as I say, first things first, the first thing that happens is the customer will agree with you and you've saved yourself a lot of time. The second thing is they will talk you out of it. The customer will talk you out of qualifying out. And then you have a much, much more, you know, grown up action-based conversation about, okay, well, if you want to continue working on this project together, here's how we will do it together mutually.
Yeah. I think the mutually part is tremendously interesting. The software isn't like awkward out there. Like, they're really focused on even building a complete SaaS product for mutual action plans. And a thing that we often hear, even from senior sales people, yeah, but the person will not let me do it, right? I need to sell something, and the other person then will challenge that and doesn't want to buy. I think that a good sales rep is more of a coach of helping somebody take an informed decision. What's one thing that as a sales rep I can do to build that trust quickly, so actually like my champion works together with me instead of against me, which I think is really true.
Great question. I think it's such an interesting thing how little trust is talked about in the sales engagement, sales processes. When we know, you know, we know even as consumers, even if we're not buying in our professional lives, we know when we're buying a car, we're maybe even buying a, you know, furniture for our house, how much importance it is for us to trust the person, the company we're working with. The thing around trust is that you can't manufacture it. There's no script you can follow. There's no sales process you can follow, even though I keep hearing, you know, these so-called sales gurus talking about, you know, these new processes that are going to manufacture trust. And it's like, well, if you try to process the manufacture of trust, you're doing it the wrong way around. The way you build trust for me, breaks down to a number of things. First off, it comes from walking into an engagement with the customer where they first and foremost see and respect the value that you bring to the table. They will only do that if you engage on the basis of, hey, I've done my research. Here's what I've learned from my research. And here's like, you know, here's the value that I think I can bring to the table straight away. So that's not just walking in and talking about the bells and whistles of your solution. Mm-hmm. It's about walking into the engagement and having had the time to really understand from the outside in. So it's not going to be perfect, but from the outside in, what kind of goals you think that customer might have, what kind of challenges they might have, and looking at parallels for companies you already work with, parallels of companies you've already helped solve those problems. So when you enter into the conversation, you're saying, hey, you know, companies that I work with like you, I typically see have these problems, and here's how we help them solve those problems. And straight away, the customer is starting to think, okay, wow, I know that company. I know those problems. Yeah. I have those problems. And you start to build the trust. And then the skill then is to turn that conversation, which is kind of a very good discovery conversation where you're talking about, you know, the industry, the goals, the challenges that your customers have and that customer might have in an open conversation manner. The trick then is to try and then identify which of those pains you've identified with the customer may have that really matter to the customer, and the ones that are either slowing them down towards their goals or, you know, standing in the way of challenging them from doing the things they want to do. And from getting into those conversations around how you can help customers solve those pains with your solution and the way, and by being a skillful salesperson about really trying to sort of implicate the customer in those pains, yep, where you're starting to make them think, this is going to cost me this much, this is how great it could be if I'd solve those things. All the while, what you're doing then is not just increasing trust, but you're also increasing the pain. And by talking about how you help solve those solutions, you're increasing the value which the customer sees by solving those problems. And if you mix pain and value together, then you create urgency. So back to your question of how can we, you know, we're doing mutual action plans, all those kinds of great things. The way you get the customer to work with those with you is building trust that you can help them solve problems they've got with value, which therefore creates urgency. And then what you'll find then, once you've created that urgency, it's much, much easier to find a compelling event that you can attach to. And therefore, that's the goal. That's the goal then for the mutual action plan to work towards.
I think the one that you mentioned on urgency and is kind of like the result of, like, if you multiply like implicate and quantify pain and then like how you can solve that is huge for many, many people selling to traditional, like slow moving industries such as real estate, energy is one, like mobility is one, sometimes insurance, banks, like who have done things for a decade or more the way they did it. But now you come up, like cybersecurity is another one, like, hey, you need to take action now. Not this quarter because that's my quota, but like in 2022, because otherwise X happens.
Yeah.
How do you tell a person who nothing happened for a decade that something will happen to them if they don't take action?
Yeah. Well, that's part of the beauty of having those kind of that research to understand not just what's likely to happen. Using cybersecurity is a great example here. So we know, you know, that typically security is one of those things that becomes important when it's important, i.e. when you've had a breach or you've had some sort of issue, right? Or some compliance issue. There's a whole sort of number of issues you can have relating to security, but it's one of those things that typically it's either like a compliance issue or you had a breach, or like someone's very forward thinking that's made them consider solving that future problem they may have, because it's kind of like it's kind of security is one of those things that it's going to happen at some point, but you don't know when it's going to happen, you don't know where it's going to happen, and so it's better to be protected. And so in those situations where, you know, the threat is becoming more complex, the threat is becoming bigger, you have like all these things like ransomware and things now, that the way in which you can get that person that's maybe not done things differently for a long time and they've not had any problems with the way things are is talking about other customers who either had problems that you've then helped them to solve, or, you know, that that you've helped, you know, in the security example, you've helped them solve those problems. And now look at all these like attempted breaches they're getting. And you can kind of say, what would happen if those, you know, if the people that are trying to breach that company actually tried to breach your company, how would you stand up to it? And the thing about all of these instances, it does go back to that that preparation perspective of going into those conversations, being ready to really have a consultative conversation with your customer, not about your product, not about your services, entirely about their business, so that you can kind of surface up what these goals and challenges are, and then consultatively how you would help solve them. And it's not around, you know, the bells and whistles or anything like that. It's entirely around, you know, what is the business value of solving those things? And that generally orientates to those three value drivers that we all know so well: increasing revenue, decreasing inefficiency or increasing efficiency, and reducing risk. And if you can kind of attach, if you can find an opportunity for one of those things and attach it to a, you know, a bigger business initiative or something you've seen in the annual report, then you're going to be moving much more likely forwards than sort of spinning your wheels, staying where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a great example. Like when you're just starting out in a new market segment as a scale-up established company, when you, as a startup, like many people say, like, hey, I don't have case studies, right? I'm not exactly StrikePoint or CrowdStrike, and I have like 500 customers. Do it because they need to. What do you do if you have five?
Yeah.
And these are all proof of concept stage.
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. I'm glad you asked it because it's a very real problem, right? It's as you say, you know, CrowdStrike is a great example. They have literally thousands of customers who, you know, they're helping. What you typically find in those earlier stage companies, even if you go right back to when it's sort of founder-led sales, is that those founders typically didn't wake up one morning and, you know, jump out of bed and think, well, I've got this great idea to solve this problem that I think exists. Typically, founders, they have either, you know, worked right in the, you know, right inside of a company with the problem, and they've either solved it inside of that company or just got so tired of the problem they're going to start their own company to solve it. And so what you lose, I find, in that kind of, you know, look at this customer of ours ABC, this is, you know, this is the problem they had before they work with us, this is how we help solve those problems, here's the value they got from doing it, which is a great kind of framework, is you replace that with, look, you know, I'm a founder and therefore I'm going to be far more convincing, passionate, enthusiastic about the problem I'm going to help you solve, because that's just the DNA of a founder, right? You wouldn't found the company if you didn't have that inside of you. So straight away, that trust and that credibility is turned up, and it will certainly overcompensate for any lack of like sales, you know, decades of sales experience and stuff. And so what you just need to do in those situations is transfer from the, this is the companies we help, to the founder story. This is the problems I saw in the company I was working for. Here's, you know, how I solve them going forward. I've got a friend that used to work for ASOS, and he led their marketing technology team. Like he was really important in that team. And he and a colleague inside of that in ASOS, they saw this problem and they built a product to solve it. And he thought, oh, this is so good how we've done this. I'm going to go and sell this, make my own company. And you know, for the, I think even today, he would probably be more credible talking about how, you know, he solved that problem in ASOS in this example, than he would be talking about lots of the great customers he has now. So it's very much around the story, but as long as you, when you're telling the story, as you're telling the story, the prospect you're talking to needs to be emotionally bought in. And so that's how you have to kind of attach it to their problems, their goals, but sort of still keep it moving forward with what the utopia state is at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so interesting how you compare like medic and like being prepared also like with mixed martial arts, right? With Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and like, and you would put all your money on a black belt in BJJ versus somebody that's just like overweight and says like maybe working for a big corp like SAP, like Salesforce, whoever, but isn't as prepared and it doesn't have this framework to refer to. So do you want to share a few thoughts on like how you came up to compare MMA and like medic and like how it altered maybe in your life as well?
It's funny because I'm not like a massive MMA guy. I like watching the UFC, but you know, I'm certainly not, you know, an expert. So anyone listening to this thing that thinks that this is going to be a chat about anything to do with, you know, martial arts or anything, you know, you people listening probably know more than I do. But the idea is that there's a few things. One was, where I think there's a really interesting parallel. The first is that if I looked at our industry of tech sales, and I look at the best companies by any measure, whether you look at like net reoccurring revenue or growth or like how much the salespeople get paid, like any kind of measure you looked at, the top of the league table, the companies were always using Medic or a variation of Medics like MedPick or something like, you know, one of the variations. And it struck me that if you also looked at, say, like the UFC, the majority of champions, they are black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. They may [S2] Yeah. [S1] Also be wrestlers. They may also be strikers, but they had that underpinning framework that was kind of, you know, it was more champions using Brazilian jiu-jitsu than anything else. And I thought that's a really interesting parallel. And I kind of do the sort of funny joke, but it's sort of funny line of like, if sales was become Olympic sport, then, and every country got to call up 10 salespeople, you'd bet a lot of money that the majority of them would use MedPick. And so that's kind of the first parallel. The second one is really that, you know, if you think about something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and again, the little I know about it, it's so much to do with the, it's like the underlying framework. You're still, even if you can be a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is no easy feat, by the way. But it's still, you've got to prepare for your opponent, right? Particularly at these higher stakes, you've got to understand your opponent. You really got to watch your opponent. Those kinds of engagements that really, for me, come so much back to MedPick. And I think one of the things I will say, because I think a lot of your listeners might have heard of MedPick or Medic, and they'll be hearing, there's a lot of people that use it incorrectly. And that is something that, you know, we're working hard to kind of shine the light on the good stuff about Medic. But it's like a lot of people will see it as this framework or sort of checklist almost that you use to sort of see where you are in deals. So it's like a retrospective tool you use to go, oh, like, have I got a champion? Have I done this?
They have printed it out in a make checkboxes, like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, like, oh, I graded the S and the K and the T and I'm missing the A and the E.
Exactly. And the worst parts about it is there's actually technology companies that sell like plugins to Salesforce that kind of take it even further. They kind of operationalize this checklist approach. And you know what happens is as soon as you put something in Salesforce, the salesperson sees it as admin anyway. So you're tarnishing something very good, which is Medic and very good for salespeople, with an admin brush. Mm. And then they're being told to go into Salesforce and kind of update. And they're going through and they're going, check, check, check. And, you know, I saw one the other day and it was like, I think there's 100 points you could have overall for your deal. And every time you checked a box, you got another point. And it had on there, it was like, you know, identify the economic buyer, checkbox, 1 point. Okay, good. That's you know, you should spend some time. For me, it would happen before you even met the customer to start thinking about, who do I think are the stakeholders here? Who do I think is the economic buyer? But this was happening because it was sort of pushed into Salesforce. This was happening afterwards. But then the next line, the very next line was, introduce senior leadership to the economic buyer. And it was like affirmative check. Another point. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. That's bonkers, right? You can't have a situation where you're giving someone a point for just basically figuring someone out on LinkedIn and then think it's equal to actually get one of your leaders to meet with that person. That's, you know, they're worlds apart. So yeah. But going back to your question, I think, you know, when I think about Medic and good uses of Medic, I'm thinking about it as a framework that I use from, you know, before even meeting the customer. So if I've got a meeting in my calendar with a customer that I'm excited to meet, then the first thing I'm doing is I'm, as many of your listeners will do, I'm sure as well, I'm thinking about the stakeholders. Who do I think is likely to be my champion? Who do I think is likely to be the economic buyer? Who do I think is likely to be maybe a competitor? When I think about competitors, I don't mean my rivals. I think about someone internally that's going to be unhappy that I'm, you know, that I'm talking to these people, and just start getting a lay of the land. Then I'm going to think about, what problems do I think this customer is likely to have? And the way I'll figure that out is by reading, you know, news articles, maybe the annual report, if there is one. I'll start to think about my customers, my knowledge of their industry, about what typical problems do they normally have. And I'll start to use that information to then prepare which reference customers I'm going to talk about and which, you know, stories of those reference customers, you know, the before situation, how bad things were, and after they started working my solution, how wonderful things were. And so I'm going to go into that meeting super prepared to talk about those things. And the last thing I'll go in with, which I think is a real like super powerful thing that I just don't see people doing enough. And this is, you know, one of the positive things around Medic is I'm going to go into that meeting with, in my mind, a decision criteria for that customer. Because I think most salespeople think of the decision criteria, if they are thinking about it, the customer's decision criteria as being like, I'm going to go and meet this customer and I'm going to listen to them and I'm going to, you know, which is good, of course. And then I'm going to understand what their decision criteria is. And then once I've heard it, I'm going to adapt my pitch to make sure that I cover off the things they're looking for, which is, I'm going to go no better and say that's good selling. I won't say that's elite selling, because what elite sellers will realize is that that customer probably in most cases doesn't have a high knowledge or a very good expertise at buying a solution like yours, right? They shouldn't, because they, you know, if they're if you're selling a finance solution, they need to be an expert in finance, not finance technology. If you're selling a marketing solution, you need to be an expert in marketing, not marketing technology, and so on and so on. And so
I think that's so true, like that. The problem is then often like a sales rep goes out like, oh, Andy, like today, like how would you like to buy this? And it's like, mate, I don't have a bloody clue because I buy this for the first time. Like my job is my job. And you are starting a dialogue about niche focus, micro niche X, Y, Z. So why don't you tell me like how other people do it, like how they went through the buyer journey and how you'd like to run this? Because that's your job, right? You do this 50 hours a week and I'm only like in a half an hour call.
Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing is that, and why we don't just get, you know, why that's not so, I mean, that, you know, as we talk about it now, it's so obvious, isn't it? But the reason why it's not so obvious to salespeople is because what happens is customers don't like to admit they don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And we as an emotionally intelligent, self-aware salesperson shouldn't like to make the customer feel like they don't know what they're doing, because that would be a bad emotion for them to feel. So we have to do this kind of dance where we pretend the customer knows what they're doing, but we know they don't know what they're doing. And so the best salespeople are the ones that will go into those engagements, as you sort of talked about it then, and sort of with almost that arm around the customer, say, hey, you know, I'm here to help you through this process. And that's where the customer stories come in. You say, you know, customers, often when I work with organizations like yours, what we see is you're having these problems. And this is, you know, this is the cost of those problems to you. This is the value of solving those problems. And the really important thing here, Mr. Gusman, what you may not have thought about, to solve that problem, you need to have this. And that is something that you as a salesperson are therefore injecting, influencing into the decision criteria. That what that does is, first off, the customer sees you as a thought leader. They see you as someone that's like teaching them. They come out of that meeting going, wow, I hadn't thought about that, but I can see we have got that problem. Solving it, I can see, would give us that much value. And oh, wow, I didn't even think that we could have this thing possible. And so you've differentiated yourself, but you're doing a great job of defending your position. So if any of your competitors follow you in, the customer's going to be straight away kind of thinking, well, does this company do that thing that Manuel talked to me about? You know, that kind of, they get into, and they're automatically on the back foot. And if you're a really good salesperson, you can say, hey, by the way, that, you know, I think we're both agreed that you need that thing, whatever that thing we've introduced in the decision criteria is. What you might find as you research more suppliers is you might find that other companies will say they can do that as well. One thing you really need to look for and make sure that they can do are these things. And that's you laying traps then for your competition to walk into, where they say, yeah, no, we do that as well.
That as well. It's like a software development company reaches out to me, like we do IoT, AI, big data. It's like, well, we need more of a full stack developer that knows Scala. Oh, we do that as well. Like, yeah, I'm sure. And if I say, like, can you send flying penguins? Like, we have these in stock, right? And trust is instantly destroyed. And I think one thing that still surprised me to this day, like, that so few people do, like, what I'd call, like, a status quo thesis, right? It's like, look, you're evaluating, like, companies in sales, like, typically, if it comes to CRM, like, A, they have none and they have Excel sheets and it's dispersed and, like, there's no single source of truth. B, they try to build one themselves, which is messy. Like, they don't have the IT resource, takes a lot of, like, internal capacity from other things. C, they have, like, an on-premise system or one that's too large or too small for them, and the sales people are not using it. Where do you find yourself, right? And just having that, and then people's like, oh, yeah, I went through all these three stages. They suck, and now I have a problem. It's like, good. How would you go about it? It's like, well, 100 other organizations choose like a best-in-class CRM such as Salesforce, Pipedrive, or HubSpot. And from HubSpot, Pipedrive is a little bit small, 4 or 5 figure deals, Salesforce is a bit big. So this is why so many customers do it. And I think another thing I'm still surprised is why not more people ask like what I call a post-mortem question, right? I started asking this after every single sales call. It's like, hey, if we in 2 weeks, even if you like the case, this reference call is good, you have the problem, it's relevant, we trustworthy, we offer you a money back guarantee, we don't end up working together, what went wrong? And be like, I don't know. It's like, well, I'll think about it for 2 minutes, please, because then we can anticipate what's coming in, right? Because I don't want to join a decision call and then go off the actual review. Oh, I forgot, like I got the M, the E, the D, the second TDI, the C of like my medic framework wrong after the call. Yeah. Like, oh, it's like if you go to war, oh, I got shot, that I don't know how, I'm just dead, apparently.
Yeah. Well, it's and your audience will really resonate with this, particularly those that are, you know, more of the technical, you know, startup founders and that type of thing, where it's like, you know, if you had a bug or you know, something worse than a bug, some sort of, you know, pretty major issue in the technically in the solution, whether in code or like, you know, the stack or something like that, you wouldn't just go, oh, we fixed that, you know, that stopped being a problem, now we'll move on to the next thing. You would do a debrief. You'd want to like stop, you know, that those are standard things. In sales, we have these bugs, they're called lost deals all the time, right? They're, you know, yes, we lose deals, the customer, and we don't get together and talk about them enough. And there's so much learning in there, so much learning in there. And I think that's saying we should do more. The other thing you mentioned about was, you know, another thing I see people think about with Medic is they think they see it, and they see it's an acronym, and they see it's a sales acronym. And they assume that in every engagement, they not only have to get every letter, and they have to talk about every letter, but they also have to do them in order, which is one of the funniest things. It still blows my mind when people think that. So they think, you know, first things first, I have to do the metrics. Then I have to figure out the economic barriers. One of the great things about Medic is because it's like a framework, and effectively what it's doing is nobody in sales would disagree with this statement that in sales, it's incredibly important that you focus on value, the stakeholders, and the process. Those for me are the three pillars of good selling. Understand, you know, what value you provide to the customer, what impact it has for the customer, what pains it solves, all that kind of stuff. Secondly, the stakeholders, you know, not just who's who, but going back to that value, who cares about what? Because, you know, in any company, this, you know, if we think about the C-level, the CEO and the CFO, and then let's say the specialist that we're selling to, whether it be, you know, let's say CMO, or say we're selling marketing technology, the CMO, the CFO and the CEO will all have the same goal, high level, but the pain they'll have will be very different, particularly if you think about the CMO.
It's very different what gets them promoted or like how a day in their life looks like, right? So I started asking that like a few years ago, I think, like what gets you promoted? And the person like, why are you asking this? Like, because I want to make you hugely successful. I was like, oh, that's new. I thought you just want to sell me something. Like, why would you want to make me successful? Like, look, it's very easy. If you're successful, you're going to be a customer for longer, you're going to tell people about it, like you're going to be available for reference call, you're going to give referrals, and it's not very much useful for me, like in terms of like the SaaS world, the subscription world, if you just like I sign you up for something that is not maximum value for you.
Yeah,
I even started telling that to people, who's like oh, do you think that's a fit for me? Like, honestly, you get like a 2 to 4x ROI. Like, our customers typically have 5 to 10x. So we're happy to continue that conversation, but you're not in our ideal customer profile. It still works for you, right? So,
yeah. And then what you're talking about there from a Medic sense is the component of a champion, which we class as vested interest. Yeah. And you just, I love what you said there. I think it's a really smart way of approaching it, which is that we say a champion has to have three criteria. They have to, first and foremost, the non-negotiables, they have to have power and influence.
Otherwise, you end up with a coach, which is still great, but you need to be aware, not that you send the coach an offer and then like, oh, actually, this needs to go like the paper process part. This needs to go through 77 hoops, and none of them ever heard of them. Heard of you?
Yes.
Before.
Yeah.
And exactly. By the way, I will leave my organization next Tuesday, so please start from scratch again.
Yeah, exactly. And so That first one is non-negotiable, to power influence. The second one is a vested interest. And this is really how you build a champion. It's like how you said, it's like, what's in it for this person? Yes. And what you want them to have is a vested interest in our success. It doesn't mean necessarily they want us to win from a biased perspective. It has to be genuine. It has to be authentic. And what it means is they see that if we win, they win. And so, like you say, that might be that that gets them promoted. It might mean it gets them a bonus. It could be that whatever problem you solve is going to reduce 3 hours from their working day, which means they can get home and put their kids to bed at night, right? So it could be anything. And it resonates
with me.
Right. And good salespeople get to the bottom of those things very, very quickly. And then, you know, align, you know, their approach to ensuring that they stay aligned with their customer's vested interest. And the final one is that the customer's selling internally for you. And that goes back to those other two, which is that, you know, if they've got power and influence, then they will be happy and willing, but also more importantly, when they do speak up, people take notice of them. That's important.
Yeah.
And of course, they're only going to do that, power and influence aside, if there's something in it for them, which is where the vested interest comes in. So on the stakeholder side of things, super, super important that you don't just think about who from like an authority perspective, but you've got to align your value particularly with those different people. And then that final pillar, the process one, is the one we all forget about in our industry. We talk about opportunities, and cold calling and pipeline generation 100 times more than we talk about improving the efficiency of the process. And what the really crazy thing about that is, of course, there's nothing wrong with focusing on creating opportunities. But when you do it so much more than you focus on accelerating the speed of the good opportunities you have, then you're leaving velocity, sales velocity on the table. You're basically, you know, if you think about it like this, this is my favorite stats for your audience on this. If you were to improve the amount of opportunities you have, let's say over a quarter or a year, if you were to add 10% more opportunities and you were to add 10% higher deal size. So let's say your average price is 10K and you make it 11K or 100K, you make it 110K, and you improve your conversion rate by 10%. So you improve more opportunities, 10%, higher deal size, 10%, higher conversion rate, 10%. But if you take
the compound interest is just huge of like, and I think we're not engineered to understand compound interest, right?
We're not. No. So
like 10% across the whole thing isn't like 10% better. Like if you have that across like 7 levels, yes, that's more like 100%. So
yeah. And here's the thing. So if you take those 10% improvements, and let's say the average SaaS deal cycle is about 90 days, so 3 months.
Yep.
If you were to add a month to that, so it becomes 120 days, the output of you improving that top line, more opportunities, more conversion rate, higher deal size, would be negated. So you would typically see, I don't know, 20, 30% uplift on your output if you made those improvements across your top line. But if it took you a month longer to close them, you can forget about all those 10% improvements you made.
You just get through your sales cycle only 3 times a year versus 4 times a year, yeah, which is just like, yeah, about like a 35%, like, or even more compounded, like a negative, right? It's like fixing 1% of churn as a 10 million company versus closing a 100K deal. And the 1% churn is just fixed, right? Like that's 100K you don't need to close.
Yeah. So I think that process part is really, you know, under thought about. And it goes back to what we were talking about right at the start, which is around urgency. The more urgency you create, the faster your deals will close. But not just that. And that's one of the things that Medic's really good at, is helping salespeople to get their arms around the process so that they can really understand not just, you know, what's the customer's buying process. As you said earlier, most customers don't even know what that is, but really trying to help, not just help the customer from the perspective of you accelerating the process, because that's obviously a good thing. If you can like map all those stages out and bring them forward and put some urgency behind them, then great. But also what we don't talk about enough, I don't think, is that customer, if you do a professional approach and you help them map out their process and they feel like you're basically project managing the deal, then it increases trust and it increases your credibility. And the customer feels much more safe working with you and making an investment with you, because they think, well, if this is what the sales process is like, imagine how great the actual team who are going to onboard me are going to be.
I think especially like in a in a time when the market offerings sometimes are like indistinguishable pretty much in terms of the value that they create for stakeholders. I think that even the buyer journey, I stopped calling it sales process because sales process is a very egocentric thing. Like for me, it's a sales process, but for the buyer, it's a buyer journey, right?
Yeah.
And also I think like just detaching the outcome from the journey, right? That's just like, here's what's going to happen. If we jump on one call, then I can make you an introduction call, get a 24-hour free trial and basically like join one group coaching session. And in 1 to 3 weeks, we jump on a decision call. It's up to you then what decision you take. We're just going to take a decision. We're not going to have like non-spin, like a bi-weekly standing call for decades. Yeah, exactly. And people typically appreciate it. Like, okay, I know what's coming in, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, indeed. I think it's like the early times of UFC when the fight is going to last forever versus there's going to be five-minute rounds. Then we're going to have a decision or a knockout before that. It's going to be 1 minute breaks in between. And this is how the scoring works, which is right now with a mess after like last weekend, but different story.
But that you found another UFC analogy there that I hadn't thought of, which is pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah, no, but I think we could talk for hours more for sure. We found out that like half an hour is pretty much what our people can run, commute, or take over lunch break. So nice. Thanks so much for sharing all these insights. Just to sum up the five ones that I gained from it, like focus on value instead of your pipeline. Focus primarily like if you even can add value and not a deal to your pipeline, and then also trust is built up on value and respect and not demos and bells and whistles. So rather lead with social proof from customer case studies and have an open conversation, identify pains, then rank them, and then also implicate and quantify these pains and how we can help solve them, because only this creates urgency, otherwise it's just laying around. And also Medic is not a retrospective after action review tool, and adding 7 fields to Salesforce will not make reps more successful. They will just simply not use it because they had admin. So use it as a preparation tool, transfer pain before that. And then we could probably talk for hours more about like martial arts and the Medic, but it's sort of like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for qualification. So
yeah, I love it. And you know, that last bit saying we're building a Medic maturity model at the moment. And
really cool.
It keeps coming back to this thing of belts, you know, like your white belt level
are
one.
Are you going to do like white, yellow, orange, green, blue, black?
Yeah, it keeps coming up. It does keep coming up. I think we'll probably only have 5 levels. So yeah. 5 would be the black belt. But the thing here is, you know, just like in, you know, something like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, if you come black belt or if you become level 5, it doesn't mean your company's level 5 for after. We would audit you and you can fall back. You can fall back just as quick. Well, we think it's going to be really hard to get to level 5 just because of all of the different use cases, all of the investment, people
for
investment.
Sure.
So yeah, it's going to be interesting. But yeah, just another analogy.
It's supposed to be hard, yeah. Are you going to award yourself like a 10th black belt, like a 10th dan immediately, or are you going to go through like this? The thing yourself, like, and you do want to do it with John McMahon or so.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, it's going to be, but in its first instance, it's going to be company based. Yeah, I don't, you know, this is like a whole other topic, but I don't think if you took a John McMahon sales team, they would be black belt, because we've evolved the way we think about Medic so much to be across marketing, product, customer success, which is where those levels of going from like blue belt to black belt will be. You know, it's that your marketing team will speak the language. It'll be your post-sales team. And so, you know, John McMahon sales team would definitely be a black belt if you were to look at just the sales team. But
like going basically lead to close deal.
Yes. Yeah. Or renewal. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's just going to be material for like a whole other episode, how you can apply Medic to marketing, customer success, and basically like across the whole board, across product and so on.
Yeah, so, yeah. We think it's an operating system for revenue teams. So there's a lot to dig into there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing all these insights, and very happy to record a future episode on that as well. So thanks so much.
Manuel. Thank you.